which are thoughts that arrive with a whoosh of emotion, feel dangerous or unacceptable, cause considerable distress, and are accompanied by a strong need to be neutralized or banished. Obsessions are one kind of repeating unwanted intrusive thoughts. There is an OCD cycle that consists of unwanted thoughts that raise anxiety and continuous attempts to lower anxiety by means of compulsions. The compulsions in OCD may be obvious behavioral rituals that feel driven, like washing, checking, ordering, and counting. But there are also compulsions that are entirely in the mind and consist of giving oneself repeated reassurances or ways to discount, undo, or avoid the obsessive thoughts. People with OCD give their thoughts more power than they deserve. If you have OCD, you probably have the tendency to feel very uncomfortable with uncertainty. And you may have noticed something about worried voice and false comfort. Worried voice is the one with unwanted intrusive thoughts, many of which are technically obsessions. And false comfort is the one who tries unsuccessfully to calm worried voice down or make worried voice stop thinking. Many of the things false comfort suggests are actually forms of compulsions. Do people go crazy when thoughts get stuck? Or does this mean that I'm already crazy? Of course not. People probably get the erroneous idea that they can go crazy from how miserable stuck thoughts can make them because they don't understand what is happening. Stuck thoughts do not drive people to psychosis, and having a stuck thought certainly does not mean that someone is crazy. However, unwanted intrusive thoughts can be so persistent, so anxiety-producing, so frustrating, and so shameful that people sometimes say that their thoughts are driving them crazy. Of course, the phrase here means the same as, for example, when your children are annoying, frustrating, and unwilling to listen to you, and you tell them that they are driving you crazy. In this case, the phrase means that your kids are getting you frustrated, being uncooperative, and requiring a lot of your energy to keep them in line. Sounds a lot like unwanted intrusive thoughts, doesn't it? Plus, the content of some intrusive thoughts can seem so bizarre. For example, thinking that you might drink the dog's stale water rather than spilling it out, that you might wonder if these crazy thoughts mean that you are indeed going crazy. But please remember that stuck thoughts have nothing to do with psychosis, and you know that odd, weird, and crazy-sounding stuck thoughts are just that, odd, weird, and crazy-sounding. What are the root causes of this problem? The real problem here is the question, because the question is based on false assumptions. Here's an example. How would you respond to someone who asked you for the best method of bloodletting to cure a person of their fever? You would, of course, say that bloodletting isn't a way to cure a fever. There was a time in the past when people erroneously believed it to cure people, but that was 500 years ago. So answering the question would just contribute to that old myth. In the same way, talking about root causes in this context also contributes to an old myth about human emotions. When you think of a root cause, you probably get an image of digging down deep and pulling out every single bit of the problem so that it is eliminated or extinguished from your psyche. This concept was widely accepted 50 years ago, but now we know that this is not how our minds and brains work. Instead, we now know that most psychological issues are a complicated interaction of what you inherit, genetics, plus maturational processes that go on throughout your life, plus your own personal history, which can include the way you were raised, the important events that occur, the stresses you encounter, and more. More importantly, we now know that determining the historical factors that contribute to unwanted intrusive thoughts are absolutely no help in getting rid of them. That's right. Learning about why you have intrusive thoughts will not help you stop them nor reduce your distress. However, learning how you inadvertently keep intrusive thoughts going and what you can do to change this will be significant steps toward recovery. In other words, we need to keep our focus on the hows and the whats and less on the whys. I honestly and genuinely love life and like the life I'm leading. So why do I have these persistent thoughts about suicide? Remember that unwanted intrusive thoughts get stuck precisely because you don't want them or agree with them. In the same way that gentle people are offended by and fight with, and therefore end up accidentally getting stuck on, violent thoughts, people who value their lives also accidentally reinforce thoughts they don't agree with. Believe it or not, the momentary idea of killing oneself crosses ordinary people's minds at random moments. Here are examples. That knife could do real damage. Could I slice myself up? Imagine if I just jumped off this ledge. What if I suddenly just yanked the steering wheel and careened into ongoing traffic? If Robin Williams hung himself, could I impulsively do the same? Most people pay no attention to such passing thoughts, and the thoughts pass right on. But if you are anxious or worried about yourself, or feel extremely responsible for the care of someone else, and you think that such a thought must be attended to, then harmless thoughts like these may suddenly feel threatening or abnormal. This sets up a struggle to resist the thoughts, and this is why they persist. So it is quite possible for someone who is neither suicidal, depressed, nor crazy to have so-called suicidal thoughts. We prefer to call them unwanted intrusive thoughts instead of suicidal thoughts, because that is what they are. My therapist told me about thought stopping. Why doesn't it work? What about distraction? The thoughts just come back. I also have tried to meditate, to find a peaceful place, and to not have these thoughts, but I can't do that either. Like most professionals, your therapist is probably not a specialist in this particular problem and can't keep up with all the latest findings about how your brain works and how to help you recover from unwanted intrusive thoughts. Most of the so-called anxiety management techniques and coping skills that have been popular in the past just aren't helpful for people with intrusive thoughts. Thought stopping doesn't work for one huge reason. It's the opposite of what you should be doing. Thought stopping asks you to do exactly the wrong thing. Using thought stopping to control intrusive thoughts is something like, okay, you have been trying without success to keep these thoughts out of your mind. In fact, your efforts are a big part of the reason why your thoughts are stuck. So you are now going to try yet another way to stop your thoughts. This time, you are going to banish them with thought stopping. It didn't work in the past. It isn't working in the present. So why in the world would anyone think it will work if you now try it this way? The answer? It won't. It doesn't work. It has never worked, and it won't work in the future. You are probably doing your thought stopping exercises just like you were told. The problem isn't you. The problem is the approach is wrong. The key is not to try harder to stop thoughts. It is in changing your relationship with the thoughts and your beliefs about them. Then, they don't need to be stopped and are no longer fed the energy that maintains them. The same can be said for distraction techniques. Here is the issue with them. When you try to distract yourself from intrusive thoughts, you are reinforcing the idea that you need to keep away from them. That implies that they are somehow dangerous and might lead to something no good. That is the wrong way to look at them. Furthermore, when you distract yourself, although it may help temporarily, you devote a portion of your mind to barring the door and scanning the mind to make sure they don't return. And it is the high-alert internal monitor that actually invites them back. It is much more helpful, and much more consistent with what we now know about thoughts, to pay attention to the fact that intrusive thoughts may feel terrible, but aren't dangerous. So, instead of learning how to distract yourself from the thoughts, your goal is to learn how to reduce the distress they trigger. Thoughts that don't matter have no power. It is also not possible to meditate away or intentionally clear the mind of unwanted intrusive thoughts using meditation. A mindful attitude, non-judgmental, curious, self-observational, is certainly part of the solution. But using meditation as a technique for banishing thoughts will not be effective. A regular practice of meditation can, like exercise, be helpful in many ways, but it is not a technique for conquering thoughts. How can it be that the content of my thoughts is irrelevant? That seems impossible. We know how odd this sounds, but the fact is that the content of your thoughts is quite important most of the time, yet entirely irrelevant at other times. You will learn how to distinguish regular thoughts from seemingly important, unwanted, intrusive, stuck thoughts. You will learn how to use the way a thought feels and acts as a method of distinguishing between thoughts worth thinking about and meaningless thoughts that have become stuck. You will learn not to rely on the content of the thought, what the thought seems to be about, at all. It is also important to understand that everyone has intrusive thoughts not worth thinking about. In fact, a great deal of everyone's wandering mind is made up of uninteresting, passing observations, reactions, musings, bits and pieces of memories, conditioned associations, and planning. Some of the thinking seems to be what we are deliberately trying to focus on or think about, but a great deal of it is just mental wandering. Sometimes a thought from one part of the mind, we like to call them channels, intrudes into another and temporarily diverts our attention. All of this is normal. Usually, if we do not focus on the content of the intrusion, it passes because it is simply not worth thinking about. But if one of these intrusive thoughts becomes a stuck, repeating, unwanted, rejected, resisted thought, then suddenly the content falsely appears to be important. In the next chapter, we provide you with another perspective on the most bewildering and upsetting issues you face, why these thoughts are so persistent, why they feel like impulses, and why they engender such great anxiety and guilt. We are going to take a neurological perspective and explain what happens to your brain and mind when you have an unwanted intrusive thought, showing why much of what happens lies outside of your control and why your efforts can so easily backfire. Chapter 5. How the Brain Creates Unwanted Intrusive Thoughts. Imagine, without any warning at all, a friend jumps behind you and yells, "Boo!" You would probably jump or be startled and experience a whoosh of fright. And then, after you realize there was nothing to really fear, the shakes and rapid heartbeat would stop and you would start to calm down. After a few minutes, it would be as if it didn't happen. This chapter talks about what happens in the brain when you get frightened like this and how you calm down. In addition, we explain what happens in your brain when you become frightened and don't calm down right away. This will help you understand why your best efforts to calm yourself haven't been nearly as effective as you would like. The neurology of anxious arousal. Let's take a closer look at the neurological engine that keeps unwanted intrusive thoughts going. There is an understandable reason why your brain tells you these thoughts are dangerous, and why the thoughts can sometimes feel so much like impulses. There was a time, not long ago, unfortunately, when people with unwanted intrusive thoughts were called weak, crazy, or out of control, or said to be lacking willpower. Now we know it is nothing of the sort, but your brain has inadvertently been programmed to keep these thoughts going. And the best news is that we know how to rewire your brain to end them. The part of your brain that was originally designed to keep you safe during times of danger can become confused and misdirected. It can become so befuddled, in fact, that it can start to misidentify safe things as dangerous. We call this anxiety, when you react to and worry about something quite safe as if it is objectively dangerous. When your brain inadvertently reacts to thoughts as if they were dangerous, it sets the stage for unwanted intrusive thoughts to take hold. As we have shown in earlier chapters, thoughts themselves are never dangerous. They are just thoughts. But the brain can become programmed to fear thoughts anyway, and this can happen to anyone. We know that the brain learns as a result of experiences. Fearful experiences are remembered and stored in particularly vivid ways. When fearful pathways are triggered frequently, they become automatic. Neurologists like to say, nerves that fire together, wire together. Just as we associate two things together, like up and down and left and right, a well-worn pathway in the brain associates two things that follow each other, and they become connected. What psychologists call conditioned. If a thought is followed by an anxious experience, the pathway from the thought to fear gets established. When this happens repeatedly, your brain becomes conditioned to react anxiously and automatically to that thought. This sets up the conditions for unwanted intrusive thoughts to take hold. The good news, however, is that scientists have recently learned that it is far easier for your brain to learn new pathways than previously thought, and that new reactions can overtake old ones. In other words, don't believe the adage that you can't teach old dogs new tricks. The age of the dog is irrelevant. Any brain can learn. Getting over unwanted intrusive thoughts involves creating new pathways that are not fearful. This chapter lays the groundwork for understanding how this happens. The alarm response. To understand how unwanted intrusive thoughts work, we start with the alarm response that is built into everyone's brain. This response is sometimes called the stress response, the fight or flight response, or, most accurately, the fight, flight, or freeze response. It sets up your body to go through a whole series of arousals, all of which are helpful when you are in danger. These responses include release of adrenaline, increased heart rate, changes in breathing, hypervigilance to possible danger, tunnel vision, and a host of other perceptual changes. You feel this as a whoosh of fear or terror. The alarm response is centered in the amygdala, which consists of two walnut-sized structures in your brain. The amygdala can be either on or off. It either triggers the alarm response or it doesn't. The alarm response is wordless. Think of it like a clanging danger warning bell. There are no partial responses or other subtleties. Because it is designed to alert you to danger, your amygdala is triggered by just the merest hint of a possible danger. Its job is to protect you, not to keep you comfortable. So, it would rather set off 1,000 false alarms and create 1,000 whooshes of fear when there is no problem at all than miss one that is real. It was originally designed for primitive survival. Clanging the alarm when there is no danger is called a false positive. Remaining silent when there is a real danger is a false negative. Your amygdala sends out many, many false positive responses because it never wants to risk a false negative. In situations of real danger, such as a car swerving towards you on the highway or a falling rock, the rapid reaction time, muscle strength, and increased blood circulation that are part of your alarm system serve you well. The immediate change in your breathing is what you need for emergency sprinting. Even sweating helps air condition you as you heat up while running. Your amygdala is designed to save your life, and so it responds very rapidly to protect you from threats. When the amygdala is triggered, people feel a whoosh of fear. The trigger might be a car coming toward you, or the sudden sound of your friend yelling boo. The whoosh response happens very, very quickly. The amygdala learns to be fearful. The amygdala learns to be fearful very easily, since its purpose is to protect you. When you were born, there were relatively few triggers that set off the alarm. Loud noises and loss of support are two of the inborn fear triggers. Babies do not yet fear hot stoves, but the adult amygdala has learned to. As you mature, your amygdala learns to set off this alarm in response to a huge variety of triggers. You learn to be fearful of real dangers and to try to avoid them. This is the natural, normal, protective mechanism present in everyone. In addition, for many people, certain animals, locations, voice tones, social situations, and means of transportation can develop the capacity to also set off this alarm, even though they may represent no objective danger on their own. Even emotional reactions like feeling trapped, anticipating rejection, or having doubts can set off alarms. In other words, your amygdala will set off a whoosh of fear in response to triggers that constitute no real danger. Psychologists call this conditioned learning. In this manner, fear responses can become habits of the brain. People with unwanted intrusive thoughts have an amygdala that has learned to become afraid, in other words, clang the danger warning bell, of certain thoughts. You were not born with a fear of these thoughts, and there is no objective reason to be afraid of them. But your amygdala has been conditioned to react when they appear in your mind. And, in our complicated world, there are a host of situations that aren't objectively dangerous, but can seem or feel dangerous. If your amygdala sets off the alarm in response to a harmless thought, you get a false alarm of danger. The bell clangs, you get an instant whoosh of fear, and it is very easy to think that there is real danger. The result is that thoughts feel dangerous, you try to fight them, and, of course, they become stuck. First, fear, the amygdala's automatic alarm. The whoosh of fear triggered by your amygdala is sometimes called first fear, a term introduced by Claire Weeks in the 1950s. She described first fear as automatic. We might now say that triggering the alarm, first fear, is the default setting on your amygdala. We know that first fear is a response of your brain that is not under your conscious control. It is unstoppable. But remember that the amygdala sends out many, many false alarms. Most first fears are actually false alarms. Only a very small percentage of them are indications of true danger. Your alarm system responds whenever it detects even the slightest hint of danger. A stuck thought, just like boo, triggers this alarm because it was conditioned to do so. Let us discuss what goes on in your brain when someone yells boo. The trigger is boo, and the sound goes from your ear to a switchboard in your brain that is called the thalamus, which then very rapidly scoots it over to the amygdala. Your amygdala fires, and you have first fear. All of this occurs in the imperceptible time of about 1/5 of a second, the blink of an eye. So what makes first fear unstoppable and automatic? It actually has to do with how our brain is wired. Let's look more closely. Two paths to the amygdala. In the 1990s, neuroscientists, including Joseph Ledoux, made remarkable discoveries about how fear works in the brain. They discovered that brains are wired so that the amygdala receives signals from two distinct and separate pathways. Whenever your senses notice a possible danger, suppose it's a loud noise, your amygdala gets two signals about the possible danger. The switchboard, called the thalamus, in your brain sends out the signal in two directions at exactly the same time. One route is direct and extremely rapid. The other path makes its way through the cortex, or thinking part of the brain, and only then does it get to your amygdala. This longer path through the cortex takes about 0.5 seconds longer than the direct path, so it reaches the amygdala about 0.5 seconds after the first signal. Let us discuss these two paths. There is a fast route to the amygdala that bypasses the cortex, or thinking part of your brain. The second, slower path goes through the cortex, which allows you to think about, or process, the meaning of the signal. The fast route is fast and fuzzy, the longer route is more precise. But you pay for that precision with some time. The longer route reaches the amygdala about 0.5 seconds after the fast route. So the messenger with a notice that something might be amiss gets there first, while the facts arrive afterward. Let's return to the experience in which you are startled by your friend jumping out and yelling boo. You jump, experience a whoosh of fright, and then calm down. The sudden sound of boo was transmitted to your amygdala via the fast route. That set off your alarm response. As we mentioned, this fast route bypassed your thinking brain and got there very quickly. In fact, the arousal of the alarm response is the most rapid response in the human body. So when your friend yelled boo, your reaction was immediate. This is an example of first fear. In practical terms, the boo gives you a whoosh of fear before you are able to think about it. You get frightened before you know why. Your reaction is rapid, automatic, and unstoppable. About 0.5 seconds later, your amygdala gets the message from your thinking brain, or cortex. It tells you that the sound is just someone yelling boo, and there is no danger involved. After all, it might have been a gunshot. It gives the message to your amygdala that it need not keep sounding the alarm, and you start to calm down. Within a few minutes, it's like it never happened. We want to emphasize two points here. Number one is that first fear is unstoppable because it comes about before your conscious will has a chance to intervene. Willpower has nothing to do with it because it is triggered before willpower has a chance to intervene. The second point is that first fear goes away quickly when you realize you are in no danger. The amygdala and unwanted intrusive thoughts. But sometimes first fear doesn't go away quickly. In fact, sometimes first fear is just the fuse that sets off a whole series of fearful reactions. When that happens, this second fear sets the stage for unwanted intrusive thoughts to occur. Let's imagine a situation very different from being startled by a friend. Let's suppose that your thinking brain, your cortex, instead of telling your amygdala that all is clear, tells your amygdala that there is, in fact, something to be frightened about. In that case, your amygdala would trigger the alarm again and would continue to sound the alarm for as long as your cortex warned of danger. Specifically, let's say you react with a whoosh of first fear to the intrusive thought, I could jump off this balcony. Then you may think, what if I actually do it? Or, how can I be certain that I won't? Or, does this mean I am suicidal without realizing it? Or even, whatever is wrong with me must be serious. These are the inner voices that keep the fear going. Your amygdala, stirred up by the voices, continues to sound the alarm, and you continue to be frightened. How inner voices create unwanted intrusive thoughts. Our inner dialogue between worried voice and false comfort creates a fear-increasing cycle by adding second fear to intrusive thoughts. A fear-decreasing cycle happens when this dialogue gives way to the voice of wise mind. Fear-increasing cycle. Let's look more closely at how your inner voices work in the brain. First, remember that all three voices, worried voice, false comfort, and wise mind, reside in the thinking part of your brain, the cortex. None of your voices have any role in the creation of the first whoosh of fear, what we call first fear. However, all three characters feel the whoosh of first fear. True to form, worried voice is always duped. It believes immediately that where there is whoosh, there is danger. It does not cross worried voice's mind that most alarms are false alarms and that there are comparatively few real emergencies in life. Worried voice automatically takes every alarm seriously, whether it sounded in response to a creak in the attic, a skip of the heartbeat, or an intrusive thought. Every time worried voice thinks of something else that could be amiss, the amygdala sends out another alarm. And, as long as worried voice asks the what if, fill in something awful, is happening question, your amygdala continues to produce whooshes of fear. As soon as this happens, false comfort steps forward to try to silence worried voice. False comfort tries by minimizing, pretending, explaining away, calming, and making a plan, just in case. But this only confirms for worried voice that the alarm was legitimate and needs to be dealt with. As we pointed out earlier, when false comfort engages worried voice, then worried voice raises what-ifs once again. There is no getting away from it. False comfort is not helping. You have now become stuck in an ongoing state of fright. This is second fear. And as you try to fight the thought, you set the stage for an unwanted intrusive thought to take root. Fear diminishing cycle. The best way to avoid second fear is to end the fear-increasing cycle by allowing wise mind to take over. It is only wise mind who realizes that the amygdala is just doing its job, that the thought is actually only a thought, and that the alarm is likely a false positive, needing only time to pass until it stops. In your brain, wise mind is the voice from your cortex saying that your original thought, "What if I jump off this balcony?" is not a threat, despite the whoosh of fear it produced. Wise mind remembers that first fear is automatic and second fear is something you can change. Wise mind knows that feeling anxious is not the same as being in danger. When this happens, calming occurs on its own, naturally, and the intrusive thought passes into the stream of thoughts. Helpful fact. Your wise mind knows that feeling anxious is not the same as being in danger. Anxious thinking. Your amygdala sets off the alarm response. You are ready to cope with threats. If the threat is real, a wild animal running toward you, an out-of-control car heading in your direction, the alarm response works exactly as it should, arousing the muscles, heart, and breath, enabling extra physical prowess needed to protect yourself. Have you ever heard the stories of terrified mothers managing almost superhuman strength to save their babies? Your body and your brain are on emergency power. However, emergency mode can also be turned on by anything that triggers a whoosh of fear. Things like social rejection, worries about health or finances, or the mere hint of disapproval from a boss can become conditioned triggers that set off the alarm response. In cases like these, where the trigger is not a real danger, but rather an unsettling reminder of past unwanted thoughts, an ambiguous expression on someone's face that could possibly indicate rejection, or the thought of hurting a baby you love, this emergency mode is the opposite of helpful. In fact, it makes you wonder whether your mind is working properly. This state of mind is called anxious thinking. Anxious thinking comes directly from the hyper-alert state of the brain. It is part of the biology of arousal. The world seems different when your amygdala has triggered the alarm response. When these changes occur and you are in the anxious thinking state, you are extremely vulnerable to unwanted intrusive thoughts. This alteration of awareness is part and parcel of the continuing alarm response. Here are some of the most important differences you will notice during anxious thinking. Thought-action fusion. Ordinarily, the differences between thoughts and actions are clear. Anxious thinking creates an altered state of consciousness, where scary thoughts can feel as frightening as scary behaviors. It is as if thoughts and actions feel fused together. Even though thoughts are triggering fears, people feel as if they are living through, not just thinking about, a dangerous experience. Thought-action fusion makes it seem that there is little difference between thinking about something and it actually happening. Thoughts no longer feel like a safe way to rehearse actions without consequences. What-ifs are not experienced as guesses or imaginings, they feel like visions of the actual future. Thoughts actually feel predictive. In addition, thought-action fusion makes it seem that thinking something is somehow morally equivalent to doing it, and therefore means something important about the thinker. So bad thoughts reveal a bad person. All risks seem unreasonable. When your amygdala is not triggering the alarm response, you understand that nothing in life is risk-free. Your actions in life are filled with what feels like reasonable risks. In contrast, your anxious thinking cannot accept any risks because thinking about something gives it a high probability of happening. What if catastrophic thoughts seem likely to occur? Any thought that triggers the alarm makes ordinary risks feel unreasonable. Anxious thinking requires an absolute guarantee that a disastrous experience you might think about won't occur. You feel driven to ask for reassurances of safety, and you try to avoid the situations that trigger the feeling. And, of course, anxious thinking can't get that guarantee. Thoughts feel sticky. Anxious thinking makes your scary thoughts hard to avoid. They seem stuck in your mind. No matter how much you tell yourself to think about something else, catastrophic thoughts come right back to intrude into your consciousness. Distractions are only partially helpful in getting your mind onto another subject, and they sometimes are no help at all. This is the neurological basis for the ironic process of the mind, which was first introduced in Chapter 1. Effort used to not think of a thought actually makes it more intrusive. Intolerance of uncertainty. Life has plenty of uncertainties, and no one can predict the future. Most of the time, you are able to accept that nothing in life is risk-free and go on with your activities with little worry. But anxious thinking makes any uncertainty feel threatening. In addition, anxious thinking makes thoughts feel threatening, certain thoughts are experienced as dangerous. It is very hard to hold on to the truism that thoughts and feelings are not facts. Helpful fact. Neither thoughts nor feelings are facts. These are just a few of the ways that anxious thinking makes you vulnerable to unwanted intrusions. Your brain makes you sensitized and reactive to certain thoughts by altering the way your thoughts feel, and this begins the process. Now that you know how unwanted intrusive thoughts are created, the next chapter explains why you feel so frustrated. We are going to explain why nothing you have tried, up to now, seems to work. Chapter 6. Why Nothing Has Worked. You have probably spent a lot of effort trying to get rid of your intrusive thoughts, usually without much success. It is likely that some time has passed since your first unwanted intrusive thought, and you have been struggling hard in frustrating attempts at controlling them, avoiding them, crowding them out, and otherwise trying to banish them from your mind. Perhaps you have tried other self-help techniques, sought advice from friends, or have even tried counseling or therapy. You may have told your therapist about your thoughts, or perhaps you have been too scared of what they might mean, or what the therapist might do if he or she knew. Three factors that get in the way. There are three factors that explain why your efforts have not worked: sticky mind, paradoxical effort, and entanglement. We address each in this chapter. We review the effect of sticky mind, a biologically based tendency you were probably born with and need to understand. Next, we talk about paradoxical effort, a central concept introduced in previous sections. And finally, we introduce the idea of entanglement, which is essentially getting involved with the thought as if it were important. We will then give you real-life examples so you can identify where and how these three elements work to make your best efforts unsuccessful. Sticky mind. You may recall having different unwanted intrusive thoughts at different times in your life. They occur when your mind has become particularly sticky and you start paying way too much attention to your thoughts. Sticky mind is a term we use to describe the experience of having thoughts that should normally fly just once through your mind, but instead keep coming back or repeat. Each time they return, they draw undue and undeserved attention and feel stuck. Whether you like it or not, you have a sticky mind, and you need to learn the factors that affect it. Sticky mind has a biological basis. It comes from a sticky brain. There are two factors that lead to it. One is genetic. This tendency runs in families and is associated with various inheritable traits and conditions relating to brain circuits and biochemistry. Most people with sticky mind can identify other members of their families who have it as well, whether they own up to it or not. The second factor is stress. Minds tend to get stickier when they are fatigued, overwhelmed by good or bad events, and dealing with illness, stressful situations, or conflicting emotions. Minds are stickier if you are hungover, and for many, even a small amount of drinking can increase stickiness. A mind is stickier as soon as you start worrying about stickiness, or checking on it to see if it is sticky. Stickiness can feel uncomfortable, but it is not dangerous or meaningful. And the really great news is that no matter what the causes, genetic or stress, are, you can learn to change your brain to become less sticky. Sticky mind goes along with feeling anxious. One obvious aspect of the altered state of awareness we call anxious thinking is that threatening thoughts become extremely sticky. It is as if you are expecting danger and looking for it, so thoughts that feel dangerous, such as unwanted intrusive thoughts, stay glued to your mind. It's like flypaper. Sometimes the theme of the content remains the same, sometimes it is different. Stickiness is a bit like those amusement park machines called the claw, in which the arm comes out, wanders around, drops, and randomly picks up whatever is sticking up in the big jumble of junk in the cage. Whatever it picks up is not even worth the quarter you put in the machine. Paradoxical effort. you have certainly noticed something very strange and frustrating about your unwanted thoughts. The harder you try not to think them, the louder and more insistent they become. Effort seems to work backward. We have previously described this as the ironic effect. What happens when we try to control what is in our mind? But the more general principle is called paradoxical effort. If sticky mind can be compared to flypaper in the mind, then paradoxical effort can be seen as the old Chinese finger trap. Most of us played with this as kids, a simple woven bamboo tube. You stick your fingers in the ends, and then, when you try to pull them out, the harder you pull, the tighter the grip of the tube, and the more stuck you get. The secret is figuring out that you have to push in, not pull out, to release your fingers. The same thing is true for all of us in many aspects of life. Here are some other examples of the paradoxical effort. Trying with every bit of effort to fall asleep, whether or not you are naturally sleepy. Trying not to listen to the TV program playing in the room while working to finish an assignment. Trying to be spontaneously witty when you are feeling crabby. Working hard to relax when you are very anxious. Trying to laugh at something that does not strike you as funny. Trying to ignore something you have just noticed. Trying not to notice a foul smell. Getting worked up is less effective when you have difficulty learning a new skill, such as learning the backhand swing in tennis, and your instructor keeps telling you to relax and take a few deep breaths. It does not work to try to force your body to relax, to feel a particular emotion, or to force your mind to not have specific thoughts. And yet, that is what most of us try, at least at first, when we are offended or scared by an unwanted intrusive thought. And then, when the effort works backward, we think we should redouble our efforts. This is like trying to climb out of a hole by digging with a shovel, stopping a car by pressing the accelerator, or extinguishing a fire by fanning the flames. Paradoxical effort is illustrated by the adage, less is more. But let's be clear, there are many times that effort works well in our lives. In fact, most of us believe, and for good reason, that hard work increases the chances of success. Not that hard work guarantees success, but people who work harder are generally more successful and fulfill their goals, on average, more often than people who work less hard. While this is true, there are, however, many important times in everyone's lives where less is more. And putting less direct effort into accomplishing a goal actually makes success more likely. This is paradoxical effort at work. You might have tried to help someone with a problem, or intervened in a feud between two other friends. There are times when your efforts are totally misconstrued, and not only are you unsuccessful in helping heal a feud or solve a problem, but you get blamed for making it worse. In fact, if you had sat back and done nothing, the situation might have resolved on its own. This is one type of experience where less is more. Here is another example. When you have a cut on your hand, it will eventually heal itself. Skin cells grow in their own time and lace together, and the cut is healed. But if you are impatient and keep checking it and pulling the Band-Aid off, you will pull off the forming scab and interfere with recovery. Passivity is actually far more efficient than effort. Sometimes you just have to figure out how to let time pass. Yet another illustration. What's the best way to handle quicksand? The more you struggle to climb out, the more you sink. It is not immediately obvious, but the way to get out is to lie back and stop struggling. This increases your buoyancy, and you naturally float to the top, where you are safe. There are other areas where effort directly interferes with your goals. Learning is one of these activities. Maximum learning requires an open, passive, curious attitude of attention. Judging yourself harshly while you are learning is not only unpleasant, it works against you. Have you had the experience of feeling pressure to learn something? A basketball play, French vocabulary, the plot of Hamlet, an app on your phone, and you keep getting it wrong? This is because you are putting pressure on yourself to learn and this pressure interferes with the open, passive, attentive attitude that is best for learning. Once again, paradoxical effort means less is more in these circumstances. Helpful fact: less is more when coping with unwanted intrusive thoughts. Entanglement. Entanglement with a thought means that you have created an inner dialogue about the aggressive, sexual, nonsensical, or otherwise bewildering content running through your mind. You are judging it, arguing with it, or trying to reassure yourself about it. Or you are trying to figure out some way to become less annoyed or less irritated by the intrusive nature of certain sounds, bodily feelings, or other intrusions. You become focused on the thought or sensation and your attempts to rationalize it, explain and understand its meaning, or just put it out of your mind. Entanglement can happen in a variety of ways, but most often, answering back or arguing with an intrusion is what keeps it going. Getting involved and entangled with unwanted intrusive thoughts makes them stronger and more insistent. Here is one way to understand why. Imagine that you are walking down the street, on your way to your car, and a complete stranger walks by you and utters a disgusting comment, and then keeps on walking. You could decide to engage him by saying something back, perhaps, "How dare you?" or "That's disgusting." But then he would have your attention, and he might say something else or even get aggressive. Most of you would agree that the best bet is to keep on walking. Don't even let him know that you heard him. Act as if you couldn't care less. Of course, you know what occurred, and your feelings are also undeniable. But the best way to minimize the event is to not get involved. Why would you act that way? Not because you agree or think it's true, but because you know it reduces the likelihood the person will continue his harangue. So, you may very well feel frightened, but you will try to act as if you are ignoring the comment. Imagine that the person making the disgusting comment is an intrusive thought. Push back, and you are increasing the chances of another comment. Entanglement with a thought often means you are hijacked by your thought's aggressive, sexual, disgusting, frightening, or bewildering content. Getting involved and entangled with unwanted intrusive thoughts makes them stronger and more insistent. We become entangled with thoughts when we take their message at face value. If we can see their message as junk, then it is much easier to ignore the content of the thought and focus instead on the meaning behind the content. If this seems difficult, then let's start with an example that we all know very well, which is from Dave Carbonell, who has authored several self-help books on panic and worry and hosts the popular website anxietycoach.com. Imagine that you open the following email addressed to you. "Congratulations! This is your lucky day. Your third cousin twice removed, who was the head of the, insert foreign country, diamond industry, has died and left $14 billion to you. In order to collect this inheritance, please click on this link and provide us with your bank routing number. We will immediately transfer into your account the sum of $14 billion. Again, accept our sincere congratulations." Would you start excitedly imagining what it would be like to buy your own yacht, own your own private jet, or buy your own island? We hope not, of course, because the words in this communication are not to be believed. The content is immaterial. This is a scam, not an inheritance notice. When you push the send to spam button, you have already disentangled yourself from the content of the email. You have no problem buying the idea that the words should not be believed, and the email is communicating a very different message. Send me your money, sucker. So why is it so difficult to do the same with your unwanted intrusive thoughts? One reason is because your thoughts trigger your alarm response, and so the thoughts feel like they are correct. But come back to the realization that feelings aren't facts, and remember that anxiety is bluffing you once again. Thoughts are not facts either. Thoughts are imaginations inside your mind. You could almost say that thoughts are a form of pretending. You forget about this as soon as you become more entangled with your thoughts. When emotional impact is added to a neutral thought, it becomes much easier to become entangled with it. helpful fact. Neither thoughts nor feelings are facts. Here is a demonstration of how entanglement can be increased. Try it out. 1. Write down the words skill and grape. On a scale of 1 to 10, what emotional impact do each of these words have? 2. Remove the first letter from each word to get the words kill and rape. Now what emotional impact do these words have? 3. Now write down the two original words once again, skill and grape. Has the emotional impact changed? You will likely find that the two original words now have more emotional impact than before. You have become entangled with these words because of the emotional connections to words you now can't help noticing. The words may no longer feel like just words. They feel dangerous or ominous or like something bad. They may also feel unwelcome. The basic message is that words are just words. They don't feel like anything unless you add an interpretation and a feeling. And then it is so easy to get entangled. Your internal dialogue can get kicked off in an instant. Entanglement increases as you become more involved with your internal dialogue. Responding to worried voice by trying to help keeps it going. False comfort is the agent that increases entanglement. Worried voice. What if this doesn't work? What if I get so freaked out that I actually do what I'm afraid of? False comfort. Don't be silly. Wipe that thought out of your wise mind. False comfort, please don't respond to worried voice. Nothing good comes of it. Worried voice. Oh my God, are you really going to subject me to these thoughts? I might just freak out. Wise mind. Not worth an answer. Worried voice. Did you hear what I said? I might actually do it. Wise mind. This is an intrusive thought. A thought is a thought. Worried voice. This is dangerous. I might have a nervous breakdown. Wise mind. I accept and allow thoughts. Worried voice. What if I can't control myself? Wise mind. I know there might be another intrusive thought that follows. Worried voice. I don't think I can stand this much longer. Wise mind. I'm letting time pass. Worried voice. I'm just so nervous about this. What if I never calm down? Wise mind. I'm floating and observing. Worried voice. What if I actually do it? Wise mind. No answer is needed. Worried voice. I'm not sure I can control myself. Wise mind. I'm allowing the thoughts. Worried voice. This is going on for such a long time. What if it never stops? Wise mind. I'm accepting the thoughts. Worried voice. I'm not sure I can control myself. Wise mind. Notice how soft worried voice becomes when no one responds. Helpful fact. Entanglement is a major factor in keeping intrusive thoughts going. Ineffective strategies. We will address the common but ineffective coping strategies of reassurance, both self-reassurance and reassurance from others. Rational argument, prayer, healthy living, and other counterproductive techniques designed to exert control and get rid of unwanted intrusive thoughts. Unfortunately, these popular suggestions for coping often encourage entanglement and paradoxical effort, and they fail to address sticky mind. So when you follow popular advice and don't get any relief, you might feel doomed and beyond help. Our message is that you are following approaches that can't work, not because you are doomed to misery, but because these approaches are simply the wrong way to tame your unwanted intrusive thoughts. Reassurance is usually the first way people try to get rid of unwanted intrusive thoughts. Most people try to reassure themselves internally by seeking reassurance from their own inner voices, from websites and books, and then, when that does not help, they seek reassurance from others. Reassurance involves entanglement by encouraging you to argue with the thoughts, as if they were valuable or meaningful or worthy of attention. And usually reassurance ends up with escalating efforts, because it only works temporarily, and your mind comes back for more and better arguments, producing paradoxical effort. Prayer can inadvertently function as paradoxical effort if the source and meaning of the unwanted thoughts is misunderstood, or spiritual doubts intrude when the thoughts do not go away. Healthy living can reduce general stickiness of the mind, but does nothing at all for entanglement. And healthy living can become a relentless preoccupation in a paradoxical effort to overcome and banish meaningless thoughts, leading to a rigid lifestyle, unnecessary deprivations, and more worries. Self-reassurance. Reassurance is one of the most common ways of pushing back. It is actually a way of talking back to your unwanted intrusive thought. At first, reassurance seems to help. Your anxiety goes down a bit and you feel better. But then the doubts come back. You ask yourself how you can be really sure that these intrusive thoughts do not mean you are losing control. You wonder whether you have unconscious desires that might get the better of you if you aren't vigilant. Your thoughts come back in the form of, "Yes, but what if?" And then you have to find some other reassurance to the new what-if question. So eventually the reassurance fails. Let's listen to a typical exchange between worried voice and false comfort. Try as it may, worried voice never gets the certainty it seeks, and false comfort gets progressively more frustrated. Worried voice: "Tell me again that you believe I'm a gentle person who would never knowingly harm anyone." False comfort: "Of course, I keep telling you that I know you would never hurt a fly. You are the kindest and gentlest person I know." Worried voice: "Okay, but there could always be a first time, you know. There must be some reason I'm having these thoughts. I read all the time about people who just snap and commit mayhem, and their neighbors always say they're shocked. They say, 'He seemed like such a nice guy.'" False comfort: "Yes, I know. I read about that also. But that is so rare, and you're not even angry at anyone." Worried voice: "Maybe I don't realize how angry I am, and I could snap. You can't prove to me that I couldn't." False comfort: "Well, maybe I can't prove it, but I know in my heart you would never do it." Worried voice: "Maybe you're just too nice to imagine such a thing." False comfort: "No, I really believe in you." Worried voice: "I don't just need you to believe in me. I need proof. You can't give me that, can you?" False comfort: "Well, maybe we should see a doctor and get some reassurance that you are not going to snap and do something horrible. Would you believe a doctor?" Worried voice: "See, I told you, you do think I need a doctor." Reassurance from others. You have probably asked at least one close person whether she or he thinks you will act on any of your unwanted intrusive thoughts. Perhaps a family member has noticed that you are acting differently, maybe avoiding a situation that you find triggering. Here is just one example. You might be upset by the intrusive thought that you will blurt out blasphemous and vulgar words during church. Prior to this, you enjoyed going to church, both for the spiritual comfort and the social interaction. But your fear of acting on your thoughts leads you to avoid services, go to church late, or sit in the back of the congregation. Your family might notice this and ask you why you are staying away from something that seems to give you so much pleasure. So you confess your thoughts and fears and ask if they think you could possibly do such a horrible thing. If your family seems bewildered or frightened, you will take that reaction as still another piece of evidence that you might really lose control. If they say, "No, of course not. That is not like you, and I'm sure you would never do anything like that," you might feel temporarily relieved. But then, perhaps slowly at first, but inevitably, you will begin to doubt the comforting words. You soon start to argue with yourself. Worried voice: "Jane says I would never do that, but how can she know for sure?" False comfort: "Jane is your friend and would never lie to you." Worried voice: "Who's talking about lying? There are plenty of things Jane doesn't know about me. She might not realize how much these thoughts take over my mind. I have to work so hard to keep myself from losing control. False comfort. I think she knows you very well, and she sees what a good and spiritual person you are. Worried voice. That's what she can see, but I can see inside myself, and I can see my turmoil and impulses to sin. False comfort. So maybe you should tell a priest about this. Maybe God can grant you forgiveness. Worried voice. So even you believe I'm a bad person who needs forgiveness in God's eyes. It's fine to ask others for reassurance once in a while, and just about everyone does that. But if you make it a habit whenever doubts arise, the additional reassurance continues the ongoing cycle. Some people actually become reassurance junkies and experience a constant need to get comfort and reassurance from family, friends, and the internet. Some typical interactions with others around trying to get reassurance are discussed in Chapter 7. Prayer. The idea that prayers can work backward is a particularly bewildering and distressing realization if you take stock in a loving, forgiving God. Prayer is usually one of the first ways to cope with upsetting feelings and happenings. And, at first, there is often a welcome sense of relief that your thoughts will be removed by God and that God's good presence will look after you. You feel safer when you are connected to God. However, the feeling of relief and reassurance, even if it comes from the belief in a loving God, is still a way of pushing back against the thought. By asking for the thought to be removed, you are taking the thought seriously and thereby giving it more power than it deserves. This leads to additional entanglement, which always functions to increase the frequency and distress associated with these thoughts. So the prayer feels ineffectual, and there is a tendency to pray harder, to doubt that God is listening, or to think you are somehow beyond God's forgiveness. Some people experience a crisis of faith when this strategy fails. But this is simply because this kind of supplication prayer continues the pushback effort and results in even more entanglement. It does not mean that you are forsaken. It is just how the mind works. Unwanted intrusive thoughts always feel that they are not you. Not that they are coming from outside of yourself, but rather that for some inexplicable reason, these thoughts pop up and keep running through your mind. Psychologists call these types of feelings ego alien or ego dystonic. To some degree, this is how they feel to everyone who has them. Let's be clear here. It does not feel like someone is out to get you or that you are hearing voices from aliens. It is different from paranoia. Rather, it feels more like your thoughts reflect actions or feelings that seem so alien. Some people of faith wonder if they are temptations of Satan or voices of perverse spirits. Most religions have some way to describe these particular experiences that do not seem part of the normal flow of the mind. The content of your thought feels so unlike you, of the sort, "Oh my God, would I really do such a horrible thing to an innocent child?" that some people think that it must be some evil force taking over them. If this happens to you, you might then begin to worry that you are outside of God's grace and feel even more upset that your prayer appears to be unanswered. Helpful fact. Unwanted intrusive thoughts feel like they are not you. For this reason, ritualized prayer as a way of coping with unwanted intrusive thoughts tends to be counterproductive and is not recommended as a helpful approach. But please don't take this as a suggestion that you should abandon your religious beliefs or your prayers. If you believe in a loving, providential God, or even if you just consider yourself a spiritual person, then by all means you are encouraged to stay with your usual prayers and worship. However, to ask for God's forgiveness, or to remind yourself that, for example, God is good and loving and will take care of me each time you have an intrusive thought, and hoping it will take the thought away, is actually engaging the thought, adding to entanglement, and, despite some temporary relief, leading to further intrusive thoughts. When you do pray, ask God to help you understand